If you feel that life is just giving you more than you can handle, please realize that you are not alone. Welcome to Abba Daddy House Girls Speak Out with your hosts, the founders of Abba Daddy House, Myrna Thatcher and Annette Smith. We're here to listen and provide help for you and others. At last, you have a place to speak out and be heard. Now, here are your hosts, Annette and Myrna.
Happy Friday. Here we are, and it's just going to be me today. Annette's having some medical issues, and so she's not going to be with us today, but we'll catch you up on stuff next week. I hope we will. I promise. And you know we try to keep our word. So today we have Steve Snyder, who has written a book called Shot Down, and we have so much to talk about. I have read the book. It is awesome. But we're going to start with an excerpt of the book, and then with each break, we're going to when we come back from break, we're going to read an excerpt of the book. So that means you guys can't go anywhere in the next hour because this is an awesome book. You won't want to miss any of it. So here we go. I threw the extinguisher down, climbed back from between the seats where I had been standing, held the emergency switch on, and began calling through the interphone for the crew to jump. The bursting of the Focke-Wulf's 20-millimeter cannons ran around our ship was the first indication that we had been singled out. Then the celestial dome blew up in front of me. After that, I could hear 20-millimeter striking and exploding as they hit the ship. Pieces of equipment and parts of the ship were flying about, striking my feet and legs. When the oxygen cylinders exploded, I didn't realize what had happened. The noise of the explosion was muffled by my helmet and headset. But the concussion stunned me for a few minutes. Someone lighting a match in a gas-filled room would cause much the same effect as the explosion, only instead of flames decreasing immediately after the explosion, they seemed to continue all around us with the same intensity. In a half-dazed state, I became slowly conscious that the entire cockpit was filled with smoke and flames. I must have been knocked unconscious for a period of time. It was difficult to see through the smoke and flames, but I could see the terrified face of Ike, his eyes almost out of his head, looking crazily around him as he tore frantically at his flak suit and safety belt. I think Hulbert had already jumped as I couldn't see him at all. As I looked back at Ike, after trying to see Hulbert, he seemed absolutely mad and out of his head. Then as my mind seemed to clear a little more, I too became absolutely terrified. And we're going to stop right there at that, and we're going to just bring Steve in. Steve Snyder is the author of the book, and he is actually the pilot's son who we were just talking about. The pilot is actually the one who wrote that, and that excerpt was a letter, right, Steve?
Well, actually, it was a diary that my dad wrote after he had been shot down about his plane being attacked.
Okay, and so he kept that diary for several months, didn't he?
Yes, he lost the diary. After he was shot down, he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture. And he wrote that diary, and he lost it during that time. But after the war ended, Army lieutenant from with the U.S. occupation troops at the time was handed the diary by a Belgian gentleman who had kept the diary. And then the lieutenant investigated my dad and found out where his home was and then mailed it to his house. And that's how it got back to my parents and then eventually to me. So I still have that. It's written on little 3x5 pieces of paper, individual pieces of paper, you know, so it's 75 years old.
Oh, wow. Well, let's just talk about you. Tell us about Steve.
I'm 71 years old. I was born in Pasadena, California, home of the Rose Bowl. And I was raised up around that area. Actually, I went through the school system in San Marino, California, which is just a nearby city to Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
The first mayor of Pasadena was George Patton, General George Patton's father. So that kind of ties into World War II.
It does.
And I went through a school there in San Marino and went on to college at UCLA, where I got a bachelor's degree in economics. And then I went into sales, actually. I had a 40-year career in sales and sales management. The last 36 years were with a company called Vision Service Plan, VSP, which provides vision care as an employee benefit that corporations offer their employees. Some of your listeners might be familiar with it because that company covers one out of every six people in the United States.
Yeah, it does. It's huge.
So I had a long career with them in sales and sales management. Last 25 years, I traveled extensively all over the United States, calling on Fortune 500 companies, and then was in charge of our Eastern Sales Division for 15 years. And then I retired in 2009.
So, as a child,
I've been married for 34 years and have three grown sons.
All right. So, as a child, did you know that? I mean, you knew your dad was in the Air Force, right?
Yes. Growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, Susan Ruth Snyder, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And then he flew bombing missions over occupied Europe and in Germany. And then on February 8th of 1944, his plane was shot down. And as I mentioned, he was missing in action for 7 months, but evaded capture and eventually made it back to the United States. But that was pretty much all I knew during my, as I was growing up. My dad, like most World War II veterans, didn't talk too much about the war. And as most people are, you're interested in your own things, and you don't really care too much about your parents' history until you get a little older.
Right, right. But you played Army and with your friends.
Oh gosh, yeah. You know, being born in 1947, just a few years after the war ended, all the movies were coming out about it. So me and my buddies, when we played Army and soldier, and we'd dress up in my dad's uniforms that he brought back from the war. So I was greatly affected by it. I've always had a great interest in World War II history.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear, I mean, did your dad ever sit around with other people and talk about the war? Did you ever experience any of that?
Not really. Five of my dad's crew, B-17 had a 10-man crew, and five of them made it back home, but five of them did not.
Right.
But occasionally he would get together with either members of his crew or some friends that he went through pilot training with, and they probably talked about it. But again, I was just a kid. I just wanted to go back to my room and play with my toys. I didn't want to listen to the adults talking.
I understand that.
I missed out probably on a lot of great stories there.
Well, that's understandable, though, because it's good to be a kid when you're a kid.
You're right,
because then when you're an adult, you can be an adult. So
yeah, I guess that's the way it goes.
We hope so. So your dad wasn't originally in the Air Force, was he?
No. As a result of the first peacetime draft in history implemented by President Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1940,
right.
My dad enlisted or was drafted and was actually in the Army. He went in April of 1941, and he was stationed in Fort Lewis, Washington. He was actually in the Army for a year. And but then he and my mother, Ruth Hempel, they got married in July of 41. And then a few months later, on December 7th of 1941, Pearl Harbor was bombed by Japan, and the United States was at war. And my mother was very, concerned about the uncertain future and very afraid. So she went up to see my dad in Washington that Christmas. And 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. And so my dad was thinking, well, how am I going to support my new family? He has a new bride, a baby on the way, and he didn't think he could do it very well on a private's pay in the Army. So then he volunteered to go into the Air Force in 1942, where he thought he could make more money, especially if he made it through pilot training and became an officer.
Right. What a decision to make. I can't even imagine making that type of decision, because I read in the book about the fatality rate of pilots and how much more it was a risk of being a pilot than even being in the infantry.
Yes, a lot of people don't realize that, but being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force during World War II was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during the war. There were 26,000 men who died in the 8th Air Force. That's more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. There were another 28,000 men that became prisoners of war after their bombers were knocked out of the sky by either German fighters or German anti-aircraft fire. So, that it was a really dangerous thing to do.
And the letters that your father wrote to your mother are very endearing. He was very faithful to her. And it sounded like he was very faithful to God also.
Yes, both my parents were very strong Christians, as they set a great example for me. I am too. They were raised Lutherans, that I'm as I am, Missouri Synod Lutheran. They volunteered and gave a lot of their time to the church. My dad was president of the congregation. I'm an elder at our church, so they had a very strong faith, and that helped them and a lot of other individuals and couples, bear it and make it through the war.
I can't. Yeah, his letters just really to your mom really shows his love and dedication. I can't. I don't know how long it took her to get those letters. You know, the time between him writing them and him and her getting them. I don't remember that in the book. Do you know that?
Well, that was the highlight, really, of for both the men who served during the war and their loved ones back in the United States, whenever they got a letter. And there was a lot of times it was hit and miss. They wouldn't get any letters for, several days or weeks, but then they'd get, a bunch of them at a time. But that was always a highlight to hear from loved ones. And they wrote quite a bit back and forth to each other, and then I was extremely fortunate that my mother kept all those letters from the war, and that reading those was absolutely fascinating. And like you said, my dad, in the letters, a lot of them dealt with their relationship and their love for one another, and that he was also very candid in his letters about what was happening
England
at the time, what combat missions were like, what life was like on the base, what life was like in England and London at the time, and escapades of him and his crew. So that was
he made
just fascinating.
He made very descriptive. He's a very historian. I mean, he wrote it the way it was. And it's very educational.
Yeah, I'm very lucky because a lot of people
I
talk to that have letters, from their dad or a relative from the war, they just said, well, it's cold or I'm doing okay, don't worry about me. And I really didn't get into much detail about what was actually going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was amazing what the detail that he did put in those letters. So there was Susan Ruth, and that's how they named the ship,
right,
B-17, right?
He was the first pilot, and as such, he was commander of the plane and the crew, and he had the last say on what the plane was named.
The plane was named, and I think that's pretty neat, and what an honor for Susan to have that plane named after her. When we come back from break, I will read another excerpt from the book. And then we will talk with Steve a little bit more about the crew and his mom and dad.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Look for Annette and Myrna's book, Turning the Curse into a Blessing, a testimony of God's healing power. The book elucidates the journey of how Annette Smith gained healing from living as a child and other people. The book is available through Amazon.com in both paperback and Kindle formats. Anyone who is looking for guidance from God and feeling that life is hopeless should read this book, Turning the Curse into a Blessing, a testimony of God's healing power. Find it today.
you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Abba Daddy House Incorporated was founded by Myrna Thatcher and Annette Smith. We provide pro bono counseling for those caught in the insurance gap. We also provide basic needs for those who have great difficulty making it from one month to the next. Donations for expanding our business are always appreciated. Remember Philippians 4, verse 3. Yes, and I ask you, my true companion, help these women, since they have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel. Visit abbadaddyhouse.org.
It's your world. Motivate, change, succeed. VoiceAmericaEmpowerment.com.
You are listening to Abba Daddy Girls Speak Out. To reach our program today, please call 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. You may also send an email to abbadaddyhouse7@gmail.com. Now, back to Myrna and Annette.
As promised, another excerpt from the book. And I'll just kind of read the sentence that I left off with. As I left my seat, Ike had just taken his chute pack from beneath his seat and made his way to the nose hatch to jump. I hesitated momentarily, not knowing what to do, and switched on the autopilot. Although not terrified as before, I was still greatly shaken and afraid. I acted more from instinct. I don't recall any thoughts. I grabbed a fire extinguisher, but it had no more effect on the blaze than an eyedropper. Deciding it would be impossible to save the ship, I threw the extinguisher down, climbed back from between the seats where I had been standing, held the emergency switch on, and began calling through the interphone for the crew to jump. I don't know how long I continued to call, but not getting any response, I felt they had jumped. The fire was getting so hot I could hardly stand it. My neck was burning, and I pulled my scarf over the exposed skin. My nose, cheeks, eyebrows, eyelids, and lower forehead must have been burned when I was using the extinguisher. I don't recall any pain from my face until I was on the ground. It was impossible to go back through the fire to see if they had jumped from the door, from the rear of the ship, and as I couldn't get any response from anyone, I left the cockpit. As I crawled down to the escape hatch, I was surprised to see Benny and Dan still in the nose. As I made my way toward them, Benny looked down and saw me. I motioned for him to come. He hit Dan on the arm, and they both dived toward their chutes. We went out through the nose hatch. When I jumped, our bomb bay doors were still open. As I crawled through the escape hatch, I recalled the discussion we had about clearing them when jumping, and I wondered if I would. I'm going to leave you there with that one. So Steve, what led you into writing this fantastic book?
Well, as I mentioned, I retired in 2009, from my career job, and that's when I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. I just wanted to go through all the material that they kept from the war years, and they kept quite a bit, like the letters that my dad had written and the diary that he wrote. And I just, after reading those, I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew. It became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe, went on the internet, spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I joined a number of World War II organizations, started going to their reunions, listening to veterans tell their stories, and finally, 3 years into this, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that people needed to know about it and read about it. And so in 2012, I decided to write a book.
Wow.
And it was released in 2014, August of 2014. And since that time, it's won 25 book awards, and it's sold in the gift stores of most all the major air museums in the, across the United States, and it's totally changed my life. I went from being a retiree to really, I work full-time again, promoting the book. I do lots of speaking, making PowerPoint presentations to all sorts of different organizations. I go to air shows all across the United States, signing copies of my book. So it's it's like I say, it's really, really changed my life. It was an honor and a privilege to write about these guys.
So as you went to the reunions and listened to other veterans tell their story, you mentioned that your dad's story and his crew, their story was unique. What was unique about theirs? What was different about theirs compared to others?
Well, most folks about the air war over Europe, they kind of fall in two categories. One, with they're either very large in scope. They talk about, you know, lots of combat missions, lots of bomb groups, lots of crews, or they're very specific and narrow in scope. They talk about one man's experience about either flying missions or being a prisoner of war. But this book is unique as it follows one 10-man crew and what happened to each one of them, and basically anything that could have happened to a guy during the war, you know, happened to one of my dad's crew members.
That's right. Exactly.
And also, thing that's unique about the book is it also is about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help the airmen after they bailed out. That really doesn't get covered too much, about the underground and resistance and how brave and courageous they were.
You know, and since you opened that door, why don't you tell us a little bit about where your dad, because your dad, I don't want to tell the story. Let me think. Do I really want to let this go now? Yeah, sure. Tell us about your dad, and he did survive, obviously, because you're here. So they know that.
Yeah, I would. Yep.
Yeah, you wouldn't be here. Okay, so tell us about the Belgian people that helped him. Don't go clear into the future, just for that helped him in the book.
Okay. Well, after my dad bailed out, he came down in his in some trees, and his parachute got hung up in the trees, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. They went back to a farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope to help them down the tree. And it was early afternoon at that time, so they told him to just stay put and hide because it was too dangerous to move him with German patrols combing the area looking for him. So they came back that night, took him to a farmhouse. He stayed there one night. They thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that. So after that, they came and moved him. And after that, he was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed at a given location depended on how brave the Belgian people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. And he might stay one night at one house or 6 weeks at another house. But these Belgian people that did hit him, as I mentioned, were unbelievably brave.
The Belgian people, they were brave. In the book, they would hide them in places. Like at one point, I think it was Howard, Steve's dad, actually, they had a place, the Belgian people had a place in their roof that was an escape hatch. And so I think it was Steve's dad, and I'm not sure, but they put him up on the roof and closed that hatch because the Germans actually had come into the house to search for him. And he was, he stayed the night up on the roof. And again, I'm not sure that was him. Steve could have done that, but obviously we've lost Steve. So I will try to ad lib as much as I can. And so they stayed there. The Belgian people would make, it's called a hut out in the woods. And I think it's called Champagne Woods. And they would hide several of the airmen out there, not just Americans, from Howard, which is Steve's dad, his ship, his airplane, but from other countries, would hide out in the woods, in the hut. And it was just exactly how it sounds, a hut. And all these men would be there. And they would stay there for several days And, well, actually, they, yeah, for several days, quite a few days. And the Belgian people would come and risk their lives, of course, to bring them food. And not all the Belgian people were underground. Not all the Belgian people would take these people and protect them, the soldiers, not just the American soldiers, but other countries. And they would not do that. They would be...
I'm Myrna. I think I'm back.
Okay, good. I don't know what happened. What I was just telling people that... that one of the, I don't know if it was your dad or not, so please correct me. The one of the soldiers that had to be put up on the roof because the Germans came in to search the house and there was a little trap door thingy and he went up on the roof. Was that your dad or one of the other ones?
Actually, that was my dad. And okay. Just this past year, I was in Belgium in September, and that house is still there.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm going to plan to make a documentary about the book. And so I was there with a film crew filming. And the gentleman who lived there poked his head out of the second story and asked, you know, what we were doing. He could speak English. Uh-huh. When I told him my dad had been hidden there at that house, he invited us in. So he took us up into that little room and that trap door and showed us where my dad crawled out and it stayed on top of the roof.
Oh, my goodness. So how did that, what emotionally, because, you know, how did that feel for you to do that?
Oh, just relating that to you right now, I have goosebumps.
Oh,
because it was just you go up these stairs and climb up into this little attic, and there's cobwebs in it, and there's this little window that you kind of prop open, and you know my dad was 6'3", so he's a pretty
big
goodness. Guy, and the roof line was very steep. And he was up there all night in the cold because the man who lived there, Maurice Bayou, said he'd come back and get him after the Germans left, but he never came back until the next day. So
you
mentioned, my dad had to stay up there the entire night on this tile roof.
Oh,
it was incredible.
It is incredible that these people would risk that much for our soldiers and other people, other country soldiers also. And I was telling them about...
If the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out that they were aiding down airmen, they'd be arrested, tortured, and either shot or sent to concentration camps. And some of the Belgian people that aided my dad and his other crew members met that fate.
Yes, they did. I thought it was interesting, and I apologize for not remembering her name, Steve, but the woman who actually ran the underground, and they did get her, the Gestapo... did come in and torture her and question her, and she admitted that she was the head of the underground, and then they let her go because they couldn't believe that a woman would do that.
Talking about her code name was Dee Dee.
Mm-hmm.
She actually ran an escape route. When the underground came across down airmen, they tried to get them back through England through various escape routes, through into France, through into Spain, over the Pyrenees, or over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. And Dee Dee ran the most famous escape route called the Comet Line.
There you go.
And she was only in her early 20s, and as you said, she was arrested by the Gestapo and tortured, and then she admitted that she had headed up this group, but they didn't think a young girl like that could ever be capable of doing such a thing, so they let her go.
That was amazing to me. I thought, all right, we're going into break again. When we come back, we will read another excerpt and talk more about the experience of Steve's dad and mom and what's happened in Belgium to continue to honor these soldiers. And we will talk about that when we get back.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Abba Daddy House Incorporated was founded by Myrna Thatcher and Annette Smith. We provide pro bono counseling for those caught in the insurance gap. We also provide basic needs for those who have great difficulty making it from one month to the next. Donations for expanding our business are always appreciated. Remember Philippians 4, verse 3. Yes, and I ask you, my true companion, help these women, since they have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel. Visit abbadaddyhouse.org.
Connect with us, and we'll connect with you. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is on LinkedIn. Get the first word about happenings with the network, where our next live event will be, and what's up with our hosts. Look up Voice America on LinkedIn.
Look for Annette and Myrna's book, Turning the Curse into a Blessing, a testimony of God's healing power. The book elucidates the journey of how Annette Smith gained healing from living as a child and other people. The book is available through Amazon.com in both paperback and Kindle formats. Anyone who is looking for guidance from God and feeling that life is hopeless should read this book, Turning the Curse into a Blessing, a testimony of God's healing power. Find it today.
Friend us on Facebook to keep up with what's empowering the world. Voice America Empowerment.
You are listening to Abba Daddy Girls Speak Out. To reach our program today, please call 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. You may also send an email to abbadaddyhouse7@gmail.com. Now, back to Myrna and Annette.
All right, so this is the last excerpt from the book that I'm going to read, and I'll back up just a little bit. Because it says, as I crawled through the escape hatch, I recalled the discussion we had about clearing them when jumping, and I wondered if I would. I did. I had been a good while without oxygen and was feeling the effects as I fell. We were 20,000 feet. I was determined to make a delayed jump, and as I extended my arms to stop somersaulting, I caught a glimpse of what I thought were 8 billowing chutes. And remember, this isn't in the diary, but remember there were 10 crew members, and he saw only 8 chutes. Someone had told me that we would fall about 10,000 feet a minute, so I started counting to 60 as I fell through the clouds, vapor, and then clear air. But after reaching 60, I still couldn't see the ground. I started counting again, but gave it up and watched the ground. As I came out of a cloud, the earth appeared for a second and then disappeared again as I reached another cloud. I was falling into the country. There were little clusters of white farm buildings, green squares of pasture, and dark brown, irregular, and leafless woods. Then as the earth appeared again, I waited until I could distinguish objects very clearly and pulled the ripcord. It seemed natural to wonder if the chute would open. I knew soon enough as the air caught, filled the chute, and the jerk nearly snapped off my head. The rushing air roaring in my ear stopped suddenly, and a most wonderful and peaceful quiet settled over me. It seemed as if I had come out of that hell above into a heaven of peace and rest. Up above, I could now hear the heavy, deep sound of the forts mingled with angry rasps of the fighters. But with the peaceful country coming up to meet me, baked in sunshine, the war and all that had happened only a few seconds before seemed like a bad dream long ago. A light breeze seemed to carry me toward a wood, and I reached up to grab the shrouds in order to guide myself into a pasture. I found I was so weak I could hardly lift myself up in my harness. I was too close to the ground to pilot my course. I placed my feet together and resignedly watched the trees rush up at me. So he landed in the trees. So, Steve, as we go into this segment, let's talk about your dad obviously was hidden, like we talked about, and then your dad was an action guy, and I think every soldier that I read about in this book was an action guy. They didn't want to sit around. They wanted action. They wanted to do something. And your dad decided to do something. Share with us what your dad decided to do.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned, the underground tried to get these downflyers back to England. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out. The line was compromised by infiltrators or what have you. And
wasn't there about 4 attempts?
Stressful on him.
Wasn't there about 4 attempts?
With his plane knocked out of the sky, he's on fire. He has to parachute out, comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, can't speak the language, doesn't know what happened to his buddies, can't communicate with the military. And any of these people that are helping him could be collaborators and turn him over to the Gestapo. So it had to be very stressful. And finally, he just got tired of hiding. As you mentioned, there's episodes in the book where he was almost discovered by the Gestapo. Mm-hmm. So he decided to join the French resistance called the Maquis. They were ragtag guerrilla groups, independent groups, small groups spread throughout France. Word came that the Allies had landed in Normandy on June 6th, and he wanted to get back in the fight. As you mentioned, he was an action guy, and he had that year's training in the infantry, so he knew how to fight on the ground. Mm-hmm. So he hooked up with the French resistance, and these guerrilla groups, they harassed the Germans. They would sabotage German railroad lines, disrupt communications, attack convoys, assassinate German officers, and they got their instructions over the BBC to the British and were supplied by airdrops from the British. So he fought with the French resistance for a couple months. There are several episodes in the book about their Maquis encounters, the resistance groups' encounters with Germans. And then finally on September 2nd, about 7 months after he bailed out, word came that there were U.S. troops on a little near my village of Trelon, France. So he went into the town square, went up to an army major, actually with an element of Patton's, General Patton's Third Army, would come up through France after D-Day. And identified himself, and they interrogated him and was satisfied that he was a Downdermen and not a German spy. And he went to Paris and then and back to England and came back to safety from England. He sent a telegram to my mother notifying her that he was alive, because she didn't know if he was alive or dead at that time. Actually, my other sister, Nancy, was born while he was missing in action. So that was really tough on my mom. Mm.
Now, did she have, what was your mom's support? Was she back with her family? Who was her support during all of this?
She lived in Pasadena, and her parents lived in Pasadena, and my father's parents lived in Pasadena, and then she also had three sisters who lived in the area. So she had quite a bit of family support, and again, a lot of support from her church as well. So she did have quite a bit of support. She had a loan from her parents to buy a little house there in Pasadena where she and Susan lived.
Mm-hmm.
And also the support of the other relatives of the crew, of the 10-man crew, were married, the other were not. But she communicated with wives, mothers, sweethearts, and lots of excerpts. So those letters are in the book that make it personal. So they had that little support group within the relatives of the crew.
I can't imagine how some of the wives, you know, the wives whose husbands didn't come back. You know, because there is a lot of emotion in the book about, and you can feel it, you know, you can feel Ruth's relief that Howard is safe, and how the other ladies, you know, well, then if Howard's safe, then, you know, my family member's safe, and they're going to come home, or they're going to, you know, I'm going to get the news, and you already know that they aren't coming home. And it's just, you know, my heart just went out for him, because you could feel the...
Yeah, that was very, heart-wrenching. And as I mentioned, five of the crew made it back, five of them did not.
And
for the people to find out what happened to those other crew members, you need to read the book. But as you mentioned, my dad came back, or else I wouldn't be here.
That's right. But we're not going to tell you who came back and who didn't, because you need to read the book, because you can pick up on all of that. And it is so historically correct and so detailed. I want to tell you thank you for teaching me, because I thought I learned something for the word GI that I thought it was just GI. And come to find out, that's not at all what it really is. It started out with, let me see, galvanized iron, used to denote the equipment.
Good.
Yeah, the equipment made from it for the U.S. Army. And then later it just broadened to government issue, and then, you know, then referring to all equipment of the Army, and then further broadening to meaning any member of the Army. So I thought, wow, I like that because if I read something, I want to learn something. So you guys got to get the book. That's all I got to say. And so tell us about what's happening today in your mom and dad when they were alive. And I think this is interesting, is the fact that his mom, his dad, both parents died in, 2007?
Correct.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. And this is like the perfect love story, guys. This is why we really think Steve's trying to make a documentary, but Annette and I talked about this to Steve, and we think it really should be a movie. This would be a perfect movie. And it's all you have to do is follow the book. But Steve's parents, they both died in 2007, and this is why I'm saying it's a perfect love story, because as a therapist, this is what happens when two people are in love as much as Howard and Ruth were. Howard died in April of 2007, and 5 months later, Ruth died. And when we talked with Steve, he told us the doctor said that cause of death was failure to thrive.
Inability to thrive.
And actually, in some shows,
we gave up because life wasn't worth going on without her loving husband.
Yeah. I mean, talk about a love story. Oh, my goodness. And Steve, that had to set an example of how to be a husband. I bet your wife, is Glenda, right? I bet she is.
Yeah, Glenda.
I bet she has one of the best husbands in the world. If you followed your parents' example.
Well, my parents, growing up, I thought they had every marriage has issues. But to me, as their son, I mean, it seemed like the perfect marriage. They were so in love with one another. They treated each other so kindly and were so devoted to each other. They set an example that it was hard to match. And that was my idea of the perfect marriage. And my wife and I have a great marriage as well.
Well, you had a great
marriage. My parents were married for, they made 65 years.
They made 65, wow.
Before they passed away, so that was good.
That is good. That is awesome. Because you guys need to get the book and read that love story. You guys really, it's a remarkable love story. So they were able to go to Belgium. They were contacted by someone, right? Dr. Paul?
It's funny. It's kind of a funny story. My parents had gone to Belgium, and they stayed in touch with some of my dad's helpers, and they went over a couple times and met with them. But in 1988, my dad got a letter from a Dr. Paul Delahaye, who had formed a Belgium-American Foundation to honor and remember U.S. troops that helped liberate Belgium from Nazi occupation. And they were dedicating a monument to the liberation of Belgium and invited my parents to come. And my parents, or my dad, didn't know this guy from Adam, a complete stranger, and they were talking about whether or not they should go to it or not. And then they got a second communication with the itinerary or the program, and they listed my dad as the keynote speaker. And so he said, Ruth, I guess we have to go.
I guess so. That's awesome. And Dr. Delahaye has, when we come back, I actually want to read an excerpt out of the book about Dr. Paul Delahaye when he was 13 years old and what has been written here about him and how he experienced the difference between the German soldiers and the American soldiers. So when we get back, I'll be reading that and we'll continue our conversation and wrap it up with Steve.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Look for Annette and Myrna's book, Turning the Curse into a Blessing, a testimony of God's healing power. The book elucidates the journey of how Annette Smith gained healing from living as a child and other people. The book is available through Amazon.com in both paperback and Kindle formats. Anyone who is looking for guidance from God and feeling that life is hopeless should read this book, Turning the Curse into a Blessing, a testimony of God's healing power. Find it today.
Have you had a chance to check out Voice America's online magazine and blog? If you love our hosts and shows, check out articles that give an even deeper perspective, plus topics about health and fitness, movie reviews, philosophy, business tips and tactics, spirituality, positive thought, current events, and even more about your favorite host. It's just a click away at blog.voiceamerica.com. That's blog.voiceamerica.com. The Voice America Press Blog. All access, all the time.
Abba Daddy House Incorporated was founded by Myrna Thatcher and Annette Smith. We provide pro bono counseling for those caught in the insurance gap. We also provide basic needs for those who have great difficulty making it from one month to the next. Donations for expanding our business are always appreciated. Remember Philippians 4, verse 3. Yes, and I ask you, my true companion, help these women, since they have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel. Visit abbadaddyhouse.org.
It's your world. Motivate, change, succeed. VoiceAmericaEmpowerment.com.
You are listening to Abba Daddy Girls Speak Out. To reach our program today, please call 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. You may also send an email to abbadaddyhouse7@gmail.com. Now, back to Myrna and Annette.
So I'm going to read a little insert about Dr. Paul DeLay, who was instrumental in building, he did a lot of research and helped Steve out, and he also built some memorials for the Americans and other national soldiers that helped free Belgium. And this is about Paul. He was 13 years old in 1944 at the time the Germans were finally forced out of his town and the first time he met any Americans. He remembers it was precisely 2:45 p.m. on Liberation Day when an eccentric local priest rode his bike through the town proclaiming the arrival of U.S. troops. He was hollering, "The Americans are coming, the Americans are coming," DeLahey exclaimed. He was spreading the good word as a priest should. What impressed him the most, he said, was the stark contrast in the attitude of the GIs to that of the strict German Nazi. And this is his quote, "The calm and relaxed demeanor of the Americans told me everything would be all right now." Dr. DeLay said, We knew we made it through. That feeling made a lasting impression on him, and he became the driving force behind the creation of the foundation in 1984 and the memorials and monuments he would eventually build. And Steve, you'll be going back this year for a reunion, an anniversary of the
yes,
monuments?
For these memorials, they have a ceremony every year on the anniversary of the event that involved that memorial. But the big celebrations are every year on September 2nd, mm-hmm. which is the Liberation Day of Belgium. And I first went over in 1994, my first trip to Belgium with my parents, and that's when it became personal for me because I was there with my parents and saw everything firsthand. But then I've gone back over for the 60th, the 70th, and then this next year will be the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium, my dad's plane being shot down, and the celebrations mm-hmm. last several days. They're wonderful events. Very emotional, very happy. All the villagers come out, all the dignitaries. They're just fantastic. So I'm really looking forward to that. Paul DeLahey died in 2013, but the association is now run by one of his daughters, Crystal DeLahey, who is a dear, dear friend.
That's good. That legacy is going on. And I know this is kind of out of sequence, audience, but I just want you to know that in the book, because it totally blasted me away when I read it, Hans Burger is one of the German fighter pilots who shot down Howard's B-17 on February 8th, 1944. He's in the book. He is in the book, and he provided insight from the perspective of a German pilot. So I think that's
amazing. I was so fortunate to be able to find Hans Burger, one of the two German pilots that attacked
my dad's B-17, the other pilot crashed. His plane crashed and he was killed, Siegfried Merrick, but Hans bailed out and made it through the war. And luckily for me, he became a translator after the war and speaks perfect English. So he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. And Hans and I have become good friends. In fact, I just sent him an email yesterday wishing him, him and his a happy new year. He's 95 years old now.
95. Goodness. I mean, that's awesome. That is an awesome thing. So another reason why you got to buy the book. I mean, it blows you away when Hans Berger's name comes up. Who's carrying, because I know this, I don't want to sound morbid, but Steve, who's carrying the legacy on for you? I mean, Dr. DeLay has two daughters carrying on the legacy for him. Who, when it comes to it, who's going to carry on the legacy for you?
Well, I have three sons, as I mentioned. They're mm-hmm. all very interested in it, but probably my youngest son, Clayton, who's gone with me three times over to Belgium, will be more of a driving force than my other two sons for various circumstances to keep the memory alive. Mm-hmm. And I'm also in contact with many, many relatives of my dad's crew, and hopefully they'll do that as well.
Yes.
So there's the association there in Belgium will continue it. Paul also had a son from another marriage who was very involved with the association as well. And my son Clayton, he's assisting me on in making the documentary, so we're very involved in that.
Okay. And one question that I've saved to the last: How has your life changed? And I'm talking probably more emotionally and relationally from before you started doing all of this research to today, after you've written the book.
Oh, gosh. Well, I always had a real close relationship with my parents, but I think this just fortifies that. And, you know, I always respected and honored and loved my dad, but, you know, really delving in and learning, you know, what he went through and the bravery and courage that he had, you know, being shot down, hiding, and then having the fortitude to join the French resistance and risk his life fighting against the Germans, because if they caught him, they would have shot him on the spot. And both the sacrifice of all the his crew and really all the men who served in the 8th Air Force and in World War II who gave their all. People just don't realize what they went through to preserve the freedoms that we enjoy today.
Exactly.
In the world. People, yeah, they just, unless you learn about this and appreciate the history, you just don't, you know how fortunate we are to live in such a wonderful country today, and
exactly.
what they did for us, and we can't let that memory fade.
No, we cannot, not ever. So why don't you give Steve, give contact information, maybe a website that people can go to get your book or that information?
Sure.
For you.
Well, it's the book's available most anywhere. Most people go on Amazon to get it, and it's available as hardcover, softcover, ebook, all formats, and also an audio book. If someone would like a signed copy of the book, they can go to my website, to the homepage, which is stevesnyderauthor.com, and there's a little button you can press to request an autographed book personalized to you.
Okay.
And actually, I have Facebook pages of Steve Snyder. I have a personal page, and then also Steve Snyder, author of Shot Down.
Okay. And if they have any, maybe if any listeners have any stories that you can share with Steve that maybe he doesn't know about, are you open to that, Steve?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
They can email me at steve@stevesnyderauthor.com. And on my website, you know, you can, my telephone number's there, my address, if you want to be all right. So write to me or whatever.
Right, because this is worldwide. So if somebody, and we do have listeners in Germany, and so all over the world. So
yeah, a lot of people read the book in the Netherlands and Germany, and really a lot in England, because the 8th Air Force was stationed there, and that took an impact
Exactly. But Steve, I just want, on behalf of Annette and me, we want to thank you for being here today. And we want to just pray that God will bless your work as you continue your legacy and of honoring our American soldiers and those foreign soldiers. And we appreciate what you've done. And people, listeners, really, you need to get this book. It's impactful. It's very, very good. You can reach us on godsgirl7.com, Twitter, godsgirl7, or abbadaddyhouse7 at Gmail, or our website, abbadaddygirls.com. Thank you so much for listening. And next week, I think we're going to do something about bullying. I think that's what Annette and I have been talking about. So don't be a bully. And we'll talk about that next week. Thank you for listening. And Steve, again, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Well, thank you, Myrna. It was a real pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for being here this week. Be sure to join hosts Annette Smith and Myrna Thatcher for another edition of Abbadaddy Girls Speak Out next Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time and 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Empowerment Channel. Enjoy the upcoming weekend.